Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Stress is a fact of life, all the more so lately with the recession and now swine flu to deal with. We'll talk about both of those on the program today. Also, we'll explain those bank stress tests and what they might really eventually tell us. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear unique perspectives on global events and American culture at americanpublicmedia.org/poetry.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Tuesday, the 28th of April, and it's good to have you here. Trying to figure out why anything happens on Wall Street can be tricky. But I think we can legitimately divide the discussion today into two equal parts. One part is that some things happen in the markets because of facts. Another is that some things happen because of rumors. Today was a rumor day for Citigroup and Bank of America. Anonymous sources told the Wall Street Journal that the recent government stress test results for the two banks didn't look so good. The paper says the banks might need billions more in cash to prepare for future losses. We'll get the official stress test results next Monday, replacing those rumors with facts, at which point we will, in theory, finally know more about how healthy the banks really are. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York.
There's been some confusion about whether banks were able to adjust their earnings in recent weeks to make things look rosier than they actually are. But Mark Zandi, chief economist at MoodysEconomy.com, says there's no way to cheat on the stress tests.
No, I don't think there's any way that a bank could fudge the results.
Which means things may be worse than first thought, and banks may need more assistance. But Zandi says even if that's the case, the banking system is much better off than it was before the tests.
This whole process of stress testing is identifying precisely how much capital these institutions need to withstand a very significant economic storm, more significant than what we've experienced so far. And if they have enough capital to withstand that, I feel very confident.
So what about the banks that don't get an A on the stress tests? Karen Petru is managing director of Federal Financial Analytics.
The two ways to deal with this are to raise capital or shed assets. And I think the banks will try to do both.
If the banks need to raise capital, one way to do that would be this. Convert the government's aid, currently in the form of preferred shares, into common stock. That means the government would have voting rights at the banks, but the banks wouldn't have to pay hefty dividends to Uncle Sam. In other words, more risk, less reward for Joe and Judy taxpayer. But Petru says that shouldn't cause concern.
The stress test didn't make the risk. The stress test forced recognition of it, and for that we should be grateful.
Get your gratitude ready. The stress test results are due out next week. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
A good chunk of however much more cash the banks are going to need is going to come from taxpayers. But in a way, though, we're already giving banks a helping hand. They're getting to keep more of the money we invest with them by giving us less back in interest payments. Rates on bank accounts of all kinds have dropped right along with the federal funds rate. That's the rate the Federal Reserve controls. And today, Chairman Bernanke and his colleagues began a two-day meeting to talk about that rate. Chances are they're going to leave it right where it is, 0.25%, which means the lean times for savers in this economy are going to continue. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
You don't expect to earn a huge amount of interest on a bank savings account, but New York financial advisor Gary Schatzky says these days rates are hitting new lows.
In some cases, banks are giving as little as 0.05%. That's about as close as you can get to zero without calling it zero.
He says 18 months ago, that rate would have been 1.5% or 2%. CDs have plunged too. David Sertner is legislative policy director with the AARP.
It's also particularly difficult for people who have maybe suffered stock market losses and are looking for a safe place to put their money. But then when they look at these fixed income investments, they see they're not getting anywhere near the kinds of returns that they want.
Edward Friedman of Economy.com says times may be tough for savers, but taxpayers of all kinds could have more pressing problems in years to come.
I think equally and more important is the fact that because of all the bailout money, the taxpayer will be on the hook over time.
And he says, don't forget the lower interest rates help mortgage holders and those hoping to buy a home, all of which is meant to get the economy back on track. Gary Schatzky says extremely low interest rates should sound alarm bells.
When rates go down to close to zero, people are all of a sudden ready to go to the edge of their risk tolerance to try to get some number greater than zero.
Which is exactly what happened several years ago when this whole cycle of risk got started. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Pfizer announced a slight drop in quarterly sales this morning. Its blockbuster cholesterol drug Lipitor has been losing ground to cheaper generics. And the push for those cheaper cures might also affect drug maker Wyeth when it announces profits tomorrow. But if the company somehow doesn't beat Wall Street expectations, you can't blame Advil PM, as Joel Rose explains.
According to a recent poll by the National Sleep Foundation, one in three Americans is losing sleep over the recession and other financial concerns. And it seems that many of those insomniacs are looking to over-the-counter drugs for help.
With Advil PM, she's spending less time lying awake with aches and pains and more time asleep.
Sales of Advil PM were up 17% last year. This at a time when the drug's manufacturer, Wyeth Consumer Healthcare, saw its overall sales shrink slightly, according to spokesman Doug Petkus.
People are simply looking for a way to relieve nighttime pain and help, you know, to get a full night's sleep, and Advil PM is a product that seems to be working for them.
Sales of Advil's main competitor, Tylenol PM, are also up 6% over a year ago. Both pills include a pain reliever and an antihistamine that causes drowsiness.
These are not sleeping pills, really.
Mayor Krieger is the chairman of the National Sleep Foundation and director of sleep medicine at Gaylord Hospital in Connecticut. Krieger says antihistamines are okay for short-term use, but
the sleep that you get with them is not the world's greatest sleep, and they really have not been studied long-term. So it makes doctors very nervous that people might be taking some of these products for weeks, months, years, and even decades.
Krieger says the best way to treat long-term insomnia is to start with a visit to the doctor. Unfortunately, he says that's getting harder for patients who've lost their health insurance along with their jobs. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
The White House asked for $1.5 billion this afternoon to deal with the swine flu outbreak. More on how the government's getting the word out about that disease later on. On Wall Street today, no outbreaks of any kind, up or down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We dug way down deep into the business news today, and we found some good news. It comes courtesy of Corning, the New York-based company that makes specialty glass and fiber optic cables. Corning is actually bringing back some of the workers it laid off a couple of months ago. The company says that's due to increased demand for its products, like glass for flat-screen televisions. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to find out whether this could be a sign of more rehiring to come.
Corning is bringing back nearly 100 laid-off workers who make optical fiber in North Carolina.
We wouldn't describe it as a recovery by any means at this point.
That's Corning VP Dan Collins. He says the company got a large order from China, which is building broadband networks as part of its economic stimulus. He says right now there's not enough new work to bring back the rest of the 3,500 workers the company has laid off.
We're at the point where we need to see growth in order to sustain what we have at the present time. We don't foresee ourselves as having cut too much yet.
But some companies just might have laid off too many workers, says management consultant Peter Cohen, especially if they expect to get work from our government stimulus.
The question really is whether companies were overly pessimistic in their demand forecasts and will find that they need to hire people at a faster rate.
Cohen points out companies don't want to lay off workers only to hire them right back. It's expensive. Economist Brian Bethune of IHS Global Insight says another danger is not rehiring quickly enough.
There can be problems when capacity is reduced too far and then you're caught short when demand picks up.
Bethune says that's what happened in 2001. Manufacturers laid off too many workers during the recession, then they couldn't rehire and produce fast enough as the economy roared back in 2003. Bethune thinks when the economy does recover and announcements like Corning's are commonplace, job growth will come first in technology and construction. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
In a lot of big cities in this country, having a car can be more trouble than it's worth, what with parking, insurance, maintenance, and all the rest. A company called Zipcar took that as a challenge and came up with a car-sharing business model. Instead of having their own, Zipcar members rent one for a couple of hours to run errands or whatever. This week, Zipcar moved into the public sector, offering its services and technology to cities and local governments. Washington, D.C. is the first to try it out, as Tamara Keith reports.
Washington, D.C. has about 1,600 passenger cars in its fleet. City workers making inspections or assessments use them. And Deputy Mayor Dan Tangerlini says they spend a lot of time sitting in parking lots.
Just looking at the amount of hours that those cars are actually used, you find that we're paying for a lot of capacity that we're just not using.
So D.C. is trying out the car share concept. The city is removing about 360 vehicles from its fleet and replacing them with just 60 others, equipped with Zipcar technology. Tangerlini says city workers reserve cars over the web and then use a key card to unlock them.
The keys are in the car. The car is fueled. You'll take it where you're supposed to go and bring it back when you say you'll have it back.
Tangerlini says the system will save about $6 million over the next 5 years. Zipcar CEO Scott Griffith says he's talking to another 15 cities about doing the same thing.
If you have a smart scheduling system and a self-service access mechanism, and you apply that to these government fleets, then you can downsize the amount of cars that governments need to serve the exact same population of users.
It's a case of technology developed in the private sector, helping out the public sector, says Robert Fuentes, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
As these budgets are tighter, they're looking for any ways for savings, and I think this is a great idea.
But not so good for car sales. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
A lot of the scientific research that goes on in this country is really expensive. And as it happens, a lot of it is publicly funded. But when taxpayers want to read a particular study that has been paid for with their money, they have to pay again to read about it in, say, the New England Journal of Medicine. Congress is about to take up a bill that would help companies that publish those kinds of journals protect their business models, but it would also limit general access to publicly funded research. Janet Babin reports now from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
People who grew up with the internet expect information to be free. That's what 21-year-old Josh Summer thought. In 2006, he was a typical college freshman, studying environmental engineering, hanging out, making new friends. Suddenly, he started to get severe headaches. He had a series of routine tests.
I ended up having an MRI and being told that I have a mass right in the very center of my head, entwined with critical arteries in one of the most difficult locations to operate on.
The cancer Josh has is called chordoma. It's a rare disease with a low survival rate. Even doctors don't know that much about it. So Josh threw himself into chordoma research. He Googled the disease to find out all he could about it, but kept hitting roadblocks.
I'd find an abstract, and I'd click on it, and, oh, you have to pay $60 to read this article, or, oh, you have to pay $40 to read this article. I mean, I have this disease. I want to know about it.
Journal subscriptions, like the Journal of the American Medical Association, can cost thousands of dollars each year. With universities and libraries trimming budgets, they can't afford all of them either. What Josh needed was free access to the research online. Last year, the National Institutes of Health unlocked the gates on a lot of research. Through its web portal called PubMed Central, you can now search research papers for any disease scientists are studying with public funds. It's an estimated 80,000 articles a year. Duke University law professor James Boyle says open access is only fair.
Why would you possibly say that when the taxpayer has funded something, then the public can't get to read it afterwards without paying again?
Well, you might say it if you were a publisher. Martin Frank is executive director of the American Physiological Society. The nonprofit group publishes more than a dozen medical journals.
The question is whether or not the NIH policy compromises the ability for a publisher to recover the inherent costs of producing a product.
The publishing industry argues the NIH policy strains their budgets. Frank says subscription sales are slipping and the cost to edit and peer review each article is rising. He and other publishers support a proposed law that would reverse the NIH open access policy. It's called the Fair Copyright in Research Works Act. Professor Boyle at Duke says the law would not only lock out patients, but also researchers.
The web works great for porn or for shoes or for flirting on social networks, but it doesn't work really well for science. We haven't done for science what we did on the rest of the web, which is basically have this open web with everything linked together.
Increasingly, open access to research is demanded, even by the academics creating the content. Laura Janicks, a med student at Case Western and studies public health at Harvard. She says journal publishers need to change their business model.
I mean, this is how capitalism works, right? The strong companies are the ones that can adapt to the changing environment, and you can't prevent information technology from progressing as it is.
Publishers may change their business model by making authors pay to have their own articles published, but some researchers might try to cover those fees with public funds. So an author pays model could end up costing taxpayers more in the long run than if they just paid to see the articles they were interested in. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Coming up, human hair commands some heady prices.
This entire inventory is valued roughly at $400,000.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gyrated 150 points today before settling at 8,016. That's a loss of 8 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ shed 5 points, a third of 1%, finished at 1673. The S&P 500 dropped 2 points, about a quarter percent, closed at 855. Part of the reason for the roller coaster was those fears that the government stress tests may have found some problems at Bank of America and Citigroup. B of A shares fell more than 8% today. Citigroup tumbled nearly 6%. Meantime, GM stock downshifted more than 11% today. That after the company said it would close more than 1,000 dealerships. Notified them, by the way, by video conference. That can't be fun. There was a bright side with some better-than-expected consumer confidence numbers. They boosted companies that make things people buy when they're feeling confident. Starbucks perked up 2.25%. Coca-Cola fizzed higher about 1% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to just over 3%. Haven't seen that number in a while. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap in marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
Here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the advanced gross domestic product report for the first quarter. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano joins a Senate committee for a hearing on the federal response to swine flu. And the House Committee on Ways and Means discusses employer-sponsored health insurance. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The spread of the swine flu virus continues to play out in the global economy today. Companies from Google to Xerox and DuPont to Nokia have closed their Mexico offices. They've canceled employee travel to Mexico and told those who've been there recently to stay home for a couple of days. The only thing that seems to have spread as fast as the disease itself is the news about it, both accurate information and information that is less than accurate. Dr. David Abramson's the director of research at the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. I asked him what role technology is playing.
The alert technologies, the push technologies, the pull technologies of Twitter and email and text messaging. So at this point, public health authorities have a lot of vehicles to get that message across. The CDC has about 35,000 followers on its Twitter. site. And I think that is one mechanism. A lot of the states have email alerts that people have signed up for, and that's pretty good. I think one of the things to be careful about, though, is if you continually get all these messages coming across and you're bombarded by them, does that tend to raise your stress level?
What about this, though? You keep getting bombarded by those messages, and then you stop paying attention.
Well, that's the flip side, being desensitized to it and knowing when you should be paying attention to it.
Part of that threshold really could be people getting nervous or upset when it's not warranted. I mean, I'm reading the news every day. I'm seeing all this stuff out there, and I'm not especially concerned yet. Should I be?
I don't think so. I think at this point it is still very much a wait and see, a time to be concerned but not alarmed. And the public health authorities have come up with new ways of surveilling the population using new data sources as well to be able to pick up on trends a little bit earlier. Truthfully, there will be more cases just by dint of good surveillance.
And trends really is what this is all about, right? Because if you look at these social networking sites, that's really what they build on. Word of mouth becomes a trend becomes sort of a phenomenon.
Exactly. I mean, if you think about it, viral marketing is built on viral infections. That's the very notion.
And in a way, this is, marketing is the wrong word, but what public health professionals are worried about here is controlling the message, making sure it's good information from trusted sources.
Right. And there's only so much that you can control a message like this. And in some ways, you can't suppress it. And if you were to try to suppress messages that might be erroneous, you might do more harm than good, because then people will start feeling as though there's a conspiracy theory. So better to sort of counter erroneous messages with really good, valid, reliable information.
What do you do about all the people who aren't on Twitter, which is, frankly, most of the country, and people who don't use Google Trends and those sorts of things? How do you make sure that they get the same message that a lot of the more plugged-in people in this country are getting?
Right, and that's where it really gets quite interesting and challenging, because it's not only people that aren't plugged in, but people that speak other languages, people from other cultures, people that attend to different news sources. And it's important to think about, from a public health perspective, who are people turning to? For example, here in New York City, when we looked at some of the communities in New York and asked them who they turned to for information during the SARS epidemic, in the Chinese American community, they were turning to internet news sources from China over the American sources. They were more trusted. So it's something that U.S. public health officials have to pay attention to.
Dr. David Abramson, he's the director of research for the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Dr. Abramson, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you very much.
There's a company down in South Florida that's got a new product it says could revolutionize how food is grown in this country. Smart Grow, it's called. It's all natural. It's inexpensive. It eliminates the need for pesticides, so it's environmentally friendly. But it might still be a tough sell, as Marketplace's Dan Gratch explains.
Let me open this up real quick.
I'm with Blair Blacker, CEO of the company that makes Smart Grow. He's taken me to a nondescript warehouse in Florida City, where the Miracle product is stored.
Come on in.
Well, you know, the first thing I notice when I walk in here is there's a little bit of an odor.
A little pungent odor, which is the odor of money as far as we're concerned.
Actually, it's the odor of human hair. This warehouse is stacked floor to ceiling with hundreds of canvas bundles shaped like giant sausages filled with hair. The hair was boiled and sanitized before it was weaved into mats by needle punch machines.
So you have approximately 10,000 pounds of hair in the warehouse that you're looking at.
How much money is this hair worth?
This entire inventory is valued roughly at $400,000.
You can buy circular mats of hair measuring 6 to 14 inches that you place around plant stems, or you can buy the mats as a roll. The hair crowds out weeds, conserves water, and supplies nitrogen and micronutrients. Plant pathologists at the University of Florida have found the mats eliminate weeds better than leading herbicides. Farmer Harry Graff was skeptical when a Smart Grow salesman first made the pitch, but Graff gave it a try on an acre of sorrel plants. He spent a few hundred dollars on mats, and he went from sending workers to weed four times a year to not weeding at all.
That's like $80 an hour, 10 guys, okay? That's $800 every time they weed it. So that'd be $3,200 you save a year.
In controlled experiments, University of Florida researchers have found that hair mats can also make plants grow up to 30% larger. Graf tried his own experiment on a row of bitter gourds.
And they were thicker, and they were taller, and they did look better. So the fertilizer potential of it works.
The hair mats are made in China, but not because of cheap labor. In China, hair is a commodity, used in wigs and even as an additive in food. While American barbers sweep hair into the trash, Chinese haircutters sell their trimmings to brokers. Blair Blacker says Chinese hair is also more nutrient-rich because it's not as treated as Western hair. That means Smart Grow hair mats, which have the consistency of a soft Brillo pad, come in just one color, black.
There's a slight nutritional difference between blonde hair and black hair, but as far as a plant's concerned, they wouldn't notice the difference.
Which is more nutritional?
Blonde tends to be slightly less nutritional. Slightly. I'm not going to say a word.
Smart Grow packs retail for $4 at the Smart Grow website. The mats pulled in $300,000 in sales last year. They've also sold on cable shopping channel QVC and at Walmart. Since 2003, more than 2 million have been sold. But Blacker says it can take a lot of advertising to get people past the ick factor.
If you're selling to people who are eco-minded, earth-friendly, it's a natural product, and they jump on it. If you're with people who, for some reason, have a negative fetish towards hair, then no matter what you do, they're not going to get over it.
Blacker says he's now focusing on agricultural clients in Florida, plant nurseries and vegetable farms. But he's looking for a few million dollars in venture funding to take the product nationwide. In Florida City, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes this afternoon, I meant to get this into the broadcast yesterday, but Countrywide is no more. It was at one time the biggest subprime lender in this country until it was bought at fire sale prices by Bank of America. Yesterday, B of A formally shut the company down. Its operations live on, though, as Bank of America Home Loans. And speaking of B of A, its annual shareholder meeting is tomorrow. Keep an eye on that one. The news to look for is whether investors vote to get rid of CEO Ken Lewis. And that is Marketplace this Tuesday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 8 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ lost 5, that's 1/3%. The S&P 500 dropped 2 points, 0.25% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this radio program, no bribes, only business for this Mexican entrepreneur.
We want everything clean. We want to hold our heads up. We don't want people to say we were involved in anything shady.
It's another installment of our series, Working with an E-Cycler South of the Border. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.